I'm Manveen Rana from The Story, a daily news podcast from The Times. Join me and my co-host, Luke Jones, for a deep dive into the big stories and investigations. Plus, each month, William Hague hosts an agenda-setting interview with a key newsmaker or big thinker. That's The Story, The Times' daily podcast that brings you one remarkable story told in depth. Listen every weekday on The Times radio app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hey, folks, it's Mark Maron from WTF. I've been talking to all kinds of famous people in my garage since 2009, including a sitting president.
You know, I don't imagine you were flying in here on the chopper thinking like, you know, I am nervous about Mark.
No, I wasn't.
Okay, well, that's good.
That would be a problem.
It would be a problem.
If the president was feeling stressed about
coming to my garage.
Coming to your garage.
And now there's even more WTF when you subscribe to the full Marin to get weekly bonus content and all WTF episodes ad-free. Listen to WTF wherever you get podcasts and subscribe to the full Marin at go.acast.com/WTF.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
Hello and welcome to the Game Football Podcast from The Times. Today, Michael Carrick's Manchester United lay the way for Ralph Rangnick's arrival. Why is Graham Potter giving history lessons on Brighton? Should Everton fans lower their expectations? And should the Premier League boss Richard Masters give some concrete answers on Newcastle United? This is The Game. Hello again, welcome back. I'm Hugh Wisencroft. I'm alongside Tom Roddy and Alison Rudd for the next hour or so. Thank you for listening in to the Game Podcast. We're going to start with Manchester United, ending their first week without Ole Gunnar Solskjaer positively. After an away win at Villarreal in the Champions League, they then went to Stamford Bridge to earn themselves a 1-1 draw with the Premier League leaders Chelsea. And there seemed to be a plan from the caretaker manager, Michael Carrick. There was a well-coordinated press as well. Tom, you were there. What the deuce?
That sounded like sarcasm a little bit, Hugh.
It's been a long, long time.
Yeah, well, not according to Michael Carrick, though.
Oh, really?
At the end, yeah, he said, we've been doing this for 3 years.
Really?
Which did come as... yes. Which did come as a little bit of a surprise, really. But it worked, really. The aim was to close down the passes into Chelsea's passing from the back, and it worked. Bruno Fernandes as a false nine, Jadon Sancho, who looked so much more confident than he ever did under Ole Gunnar Solskjaer, and Marcus Rashford had a decent game too, but it's modern day football, isn't it? And something that Man United would have had to do.
Look at the week they've had. A win away in the Champions League, a draw at Chelsea, which, to be honest, was a good result even when Sir Alex Ferguson was in charge. Should be delighted.
It was a hilarious match. I don't know how you can be delighted if you're a United fan. And if you are delighted as a United fan, look how far you've fallen. If that pleases you, for goodness sake. You lot, you scored because of a freakish floodlight blindness by Jorginho, bless him, gazing up into the stars, thinking about his Ballon d'Or, and then realised the floodlights were very bright and then he couldn't see the ball. And so that's freaky, isn't it? I like Sancho's confidence. I'm going to score this. I'm not passing. This is mine. That was good. But that's what? That's 3 seconds out of 90 plus added time. Not great if you're relying on something freaky like that. And so what? They pressed a bit. They didn't press very much for most of the second half, actually. It was quite static. And I think people say there's a plan if Ronaldo's put on the bench. They think someone must have thought about it and therefore ascribe poncy words like thoughtfulness and thinking it through and thinking about the greater good. I thought it was slightly hilarious, a freaky game, and not one from which we should draw too many conclusions. And the added extra bit of humour at the end was Michael Carrick denying it had anything at all to do with the incoming maestro of Ralphness.
What do you think it did?
Well, everyone but Carrick thinks it did. So either Carrick's fibbing or everyone else is misinformed.
Whether he...
Tom Roddy seems to think it has something to do with
Ralphness. Yeah, absolutely, I do. Whether he directly has spoken to him or not, I think the influence of Rangnick coming in is what Carrick was thinking as he picked that team.
Oh, so a subconscious influence that Carrick himself wasn't aware of. Interesting, Tom. Very interesting.
Yeah, I mean, look, Manchester United fans won't be overjoyed by the fact they had 34% possession. They allowed Chelsea to have 24 shots. Antonio Rudiger really should have won it. Timo Werner probably lost it for Chelsea in the end. But you've got to be encouraged by the last week if you're a Manchester United fan. It suggests there will be a turnaround. The season will not be all lost.
But from that Watford game, it could only go up. I mean, they'd entirely given up from that Watford game. At least there were challenges made at Chelsea and against Villarreal. We can't talk about Man United without talking about the Ronaldo decision to put him on the bench. But I do think that actually also goes back into the fact he had to pick a midfield three to protect a defence without Rafa Varane and without Harry Maguire. Eric Bailly, who Ole Gunnar Solskjaer chose Harry Maguire ahead of 40% fit Harry Maguire ahead of Eric Bailly, and Lindelof, who I've watched United play at Watford and at Stamford Bridge, and I don't think I've seen him make a challenge yet.
I think some Manchester United fans were encouraged by Lindelof's performance.
You are out as a Man United supporter, so I'm not embarrassing you here. But what did United do that you wouldn't expect any team in the Premier League to do?
Oh, no. I mean, my overall takeaway was Manchester United are bang average, actually. And all my Manchester United mates that were sort of celebrating their point. Oh, everyone thought we were going to get battered and we got a point away at Stamford Bridge. I was like, well, we just looked like a bit of a mid-table side that thought, you know, if we can batten down the hatches in the second half, we've nicked a goal. You know, maybe we can get a point out of it. It wasn't, you know, it's nothing inspiring, let's put it that way.
Well, Thomas Tuchel compared it to the Burnley game, and Burnley managed to get a point as well. Mm. I mean, for him, as I don't think he was trying to, you know, be mean-spirited, but that was the level he saw it at. It's a team that were limited. He felt his own team were much, much superior, and yet, you know, that's the way it goes sometimes. If you work hard, you'll get a point. Well, I like hard work, but I just don't see this as a massive corner turn.
No, I tend to agree with you and Thomas Tuchel as well. I don't think it's a massive corner turn, but it's a green shoot. Can I not hold on to that? You know, it's, for me, it is a step in the right direction. And then you hope that Ralf Rangnick will make more steps in the right direction and they will, you know, I know you said it was a very low base at Watford, but I think it was okay this week.
Do we ever see a corner turns immediately? I mean, even the speed at which Tuchel transformed Chelsea, the first game was quite a dull 0-0 against Wolves, wasn't it? It's what happens when a manager gets sacked. Takes a bit more than a few days, doesn't it?
You're just deflating me. And this is very deliberate. You two had a conversation.
Oh, we did.
You did, out in the coffee room. You've teamed up on me and I'm not happy about it.
Is it working?
It is, yeah. I'm feeling very glum now. Let's talk about that Ronaldo decision, though, from Michael Carrick to leave him on the bench that you mentioned, Alison. Because you're right. I think the takeaway is, Carrick had a plan here. You know, this is a very deliberate... Why would you leave Ronaldo on the bench? Why would you want to annoy Roy Keane to this extent? You know, whatever it might be. So he said that they'd had a conversation and that Ronaldo was great about it. Do you think this is something that we'll have to get used to this season, seeing Ronaldo on the bench more?
Possibly. I think the thing is, all the talk is about Ralf Rangnick and his desire to develop, or his reputation for developing young players. But at the same time, surely it would be foolish to walk into a club like Man United that is full of politics and unsettle someone as influential as Ronaldo. So I don't think we're going to see him sat on the bench every single week.
Most weeks?
Honestly, I'm not sure. Mm. I don't know. We'll, because Rangnick has never come into a club like Man United before. And what's fascinating is the fact that he's not, you know, what he did at Hoffenheim was impressive. What he did at Leipzig was incredible. But he was building clubs. He was, you know, almost a blank canvas, and at Man United it's a very muddy canvas already. It's rebuilding, isn't it? Restructuring. It's correcting. It's not as straightforward as his sort of CV. His CV isn't the same, is it, really, with this?
I think we've seen the birth of the super sub Cristiano now.
Oh yeah?
Yeah. I think that's
the
only logical...
Why are you so happy about it? She's got a grin ear to ear. Whoa, do you hate him or something?
No, but it is slightly ludicrous that... Because he's had arguably is, having an incredible career, and the way he does pop up and get those goals means he is a special player. But he is a human being and he is getting older, and he can't do the things that younger players can do. He can't press. His game isn't built on that for a start. And also, it just biology means he's not going to be as energetic as someone who's 21. So you have to think about the team and not... You have to get that balance right between what he brings in sort of ethereal, intangible force of personality sense and how much you're prepared to absorb someone who loiters. I mean, you know, he's probably the world's most famous goal hanger is Cristiano Ronaldo, you could argue. And you have to balance that. They're all positives, but you have to balance that with what you achieve as a team by working as a team and working hard as a team. And United are a side that have to up their work rate by quite a lot if that's the path they're going to go down, or they wouldn't be approaching Ralph if they... It's funny how people get called Ralph by their first name, because it's still quite a cute name, I think.
There's a lot of that going around. Come on, there's a lot of that going around. It's not just Ralph's.
No, Ralph is one of them. Ralph's one of those names.
So you think we'll all call him Ralph?
I like Ralph. Yeah.
Will we all just go, oh, Ralph's done this. He's already...
Conte isn't Antonio, is he?
No, exactly.
No.
But Jose is Jose, isn't he?
Jose's Jose. Yeah, I like to call it... He's actually a Mourinho to me.
Oh.
Yeah.
Is that because you're not a fan?
It's not nice enough to be called Jose. Pep's a Pep. Klopp is Klopp. He's not a Jurgen.
No.
I've heard Rodgers called Brendan. No, not for me. Rodgers only. We could go down the full league if you like, but there is a politic to it.
Sticking with what Alison said, what's really interesting will be to see if Rangnick tries to get Ronaldo.
You're not calling him Ralph, though.
I know,
so you're rubbishing the whole thing.
And Rangnick isn't coming out of my mouth very
nicely.
Sounds
like you're being sick. That's the problem.
It'll be interesting to see if Ralphie gets Chris pressing. attempts to, because I saw him talking about Mane, Firmino and Salah, and how he worked with two of them, right? Mane and Firmino, Hoffenheim and Leipzig. And he was talking about the way when they arrived, they weren't pressing players, but now they're known as, you know, that's their quality. They didn't arrive in that way, but the difference is how young they were. But does he try and get Ronaldo, does he make any attempt to try and get Ronaldo pressing?
I'm happy as a Manchester United fan if he can get all the younger ones pressing, because Jadon Sancho isn't bad at it, Mason Greenwood is pretty awful at it. It would be good to see if Rashford can do that continuously. If he can get anything out of Anthony Martial before he gets sold, that would be great as well. No, I just think he needs to lay the foundation. That's the job that he seems to have been given. But if he can turn some of those players into harder working players who actually just run with an intention, a design, a knowledge in what they're doing. What we have is we have people who just sort of run towards a player. They don't really know why they're doing or what it's meant to achieve. We have that a lot under Ole Gunnar Solskjaer. So if there's some sort of coordination in that press and the players actually know why they're doing it, then I will be happy.
Do you think this changes Lingard's future? Because he feels like he
will play, but I don't. I think it's too late in the day now. I think he's set his mind on going somewhere else where he will be valued, and he deserves it, really. So I think if he were staying at the club, then yeah, he would play much more regularly.
I just wanted to expand on what you said earlier, Hugh. You said a player of Ronaldo's influence. Is he influential now at Old Trafford? When you say influence, I think really the influence he has is that it gets former Man United icons to bleat on and on and on about what he means to the club, because they're living in the era when he was there first, and they know the impact he had then, and they know how amazing he's been in Europe. But now, coming back into Old Trafford, does he really wield power?
I think so. I actually don't think Ole Gunnar Solskjaer would have got sacked unless he was there, Ronaldo. Not for a football reason, but aside from the fact it sends the signal that we should be a fantastic club challenging for trophies because Cristiano Ronaldo is up front for us. Aside from that, I think he would have drawn the line over the performances, where I don't think maybe anyone in the squad would have previously. You know, you could see his face at the end of matches. You know, it was very abundantly obvious to him, this is unacceptable. And I think there are very few people inside Manchester United for whom those performances would have been unacceptable for if this was last season. you know, in fact, there have been times under Solskjaer where many fans would have said, it's not going to happen. It's very obvious he's not the person for the job. There are very good candidates out there. Let's move on. That line was not drawn until Cristiano Ronaldo was at the club. I don't know if there have been private conversations going on, but I did think that the tide would definitely change with his presence. Whether that means he's a big influence or not, I don't know, but I think he is. I think
his scowling is a big influence,
yeah,
is what you're saying.
Yeah, but not just that. I mean, the fact that Carrick is saying, well, you know, I had to sit down with him earlier this week, and he's 30, almost 37 years old. I mean, what, do you really have to explain to him why he's going to be on the bench and do this man management thing? He's won everything. He knows the game inside out, but Carrick still feels he has to treat that player with that amount of care. So there's definitely an influence there, for sure. But it wasn't on the pitch yesterday, unfortunately. Let's talk about Jorginho, who had an influence at both ends of the pitch. Firstly, for Manchester United's goal, what was he doing, Tom?
He was looking up into the lights, as Alisson referred to earlier. It was awful. It was sort of Demba Ba-esque a little bit, and a terrific finish from Sancho.
Well, terrific finish. I mean, he took it well, but Marcus Rashford ran offside. I mean, he gave him no option to pass it. I don't know what Rashford was doing. He was about a yard in front of him. It was like, cheers, mate. If that had got saved, it would have been all Rashford's fault.
It was one of those situations, though, where you felt he had so much time, Sancho, and for a player who's struggled with confidence recently, you thought, it's too much time. Is he going to overthink this? And then watching what he does for the finish is not someone who's been lacking in confidence at all. But on Jorginho, what we can't forget with the penalty he had is that he's just missed two really important penalties for Italy that put them in a playoff situation. So it was quite impressive to watch him.
I was surprised by his penalty, I've got to say, because I'm a big Jorginho penalty fan, but only when he does the stuttered run. I actually think the goalkeeper has a pretty good chance of saving it when he doesn't do the stuttered run. So I thought, as he addressed the ball, I thought he's going to do the stutter, he's going to wait, see where the goalkeeper goes, roll it in the other corner. In the end, he did put it in the corner of the goal, but there was no stuttered run. And you sort of thought, if De Gea had guessed the right way, that was a pretty comfortable height. It wasn't smashed in.
There was a bit of a stutter. There was sort of a... I don't know how to describe
hanging
it.
Hanging his right leg back before. Just a small delay. Bizarre. Yeah? Okay. Well, he scored. So, you know, he got the job done in the end. I just worry for him long term, you know?
I love... But don't you just love the psychology of penalty taking and who takes them? Because really, logically, Reece James should have taken that penalty. Because the last two League Cup games Chelsea have been involved in have gone to a penalty shootout, and the last penalty has been taken by Reece James. So that's the one that really matters, front of the home fans. It's a tense situation, and he looks as cool as you like, and his penalties are unstoppable. They're very well executed. He has such power, Reece James, such a powerful striker of the ball. So given all that, given he knows how to take a spotlight, really difficult moment penalty, and as you say, Tom, Jorginho's been missing them. Logically, if it's just purely on who's been doing what and how they do it, you'd have given it to Reece James. There's always more to it, isn't there? And there is this sense of wanting not to undermine a player. What it would mean in terms of redemption, because it was his mistake that gave United the goal. These things are romantic notions, and they should not be part of it, I don't think. But they are. They are, inevitably are. And Thomas Tuchel will be feeling absolutely chuffed to bits that he was able to afterwards talk mostly about how proud he was of how Jorginho held his nerve after feeling like he'd let his team down and so on. Because you've ended up turning a negative into a double positive when it really wasn't. It was just cancelling out one mistake.
Timo Werner. Got to talk about him next, particularly as we've got his doppelganger Tom Roddy here. is he done, Tom? Is he done? I mean, he had so many chances in that game. He just doesn't look a natural. At a team like Chelsea, with Romelu Lukaku coming back from injury off the bench at the end of the game, you would have thought, had he started and been fit and firing, Lukaku would have had a field day.
I remember going to a pre-season game at Stamford Bridge against Tottenham, and Werner missed 2-3 chances. I mean, the ones we're seeing like yesterday, exactly the same. And the shed end was still sort of singing his name. And I thought, yeah, wait until it gets into the mid-season and it becomes crucial and important matches. It hasn't made a difference. I don't know if it's the fact they're leading the table, but that was two drop points again for Chelsea yesterday. They were really poor misses from Werner. And still, he has the support of the fans there because of the effort he puts in. But you thought watching that, that Lukaku would have put those chances away. And even away from it, sometimes his movement is a little bit strange. He does get into dangerous areas and creates these opportunities. But there were a few times where Reece James, as Alison just mentioned, his delivery is incredible. And there was no one there. And you just thought he should have been the one to do it. And Tuchel mentioned his injury, and he is coming back from a hamstring injury, but that felt like an excuse to me.
Will he go, though? I saw some Chelsea fans saying he should leave the club in January next summer.
One problem is that I think tiny part of Tuchel's remit was to get the best out of him. And if he went in January, it's a bit like, I failed, isn't it? Look at me, I failed. This is a player, cost a lot of money and definitely has a lot of potential. He's still playing okay for Germany, isn't he? I mean, he's scoring anyway. It's a tricky one again in terms of the optics, in terms of what it says about the inability to get the most out of a player. And as Tom says, the fans know he's trying hard. He's not one of these sulky players who regrets moving to London. He's not one of these players who says, oh, I can't stand the traffic and I wish I was back living in my little village, wherever this little village is. He's trying very hard and fans do appreciate that. But there's something not quite right. And you do feel a good coach would be able to find that golden key to unlock it somehow.
It was a good result for the title race, though, wasn't it? It's very, very tight. I think 2 points separating the top three clubs, and it's the three we expected. I've no questions on this, really, but I just think we could see what we've dreamt of for so long, which is a genuine, nail-biting, tense title race down to the last couple of games with several teams, which would be great, wouldn't it?
Of course it would.
Yeah.
Yeah, I honestly, I'm not even sure, hand on heart, if you're the fan of a club that's capable of winning the title, you'd rather win it by goal difference on the final day, wouldn't you? I mean, you just would. I would.
Nah. I'll take an 18-point title win celebrating with 5 games to go, to be perfectly honest. I just can't take the nerves. Listen, we've got a lot still to discuss. We're going to be talking about Everton and Brighton. We'll talk about Richard Masters, the Premier League chief executive, and this independent review and what he's had to say about Newcastle United as well. So stay with us on the game. Remember, if you're enjoying it, rate us, leave us a review, and make sure you're subscribed.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Off Air, the podcast with Jane Garvey and Fee Glover.
I go to the sink and I have some cheese.
Keep your cheese in the sink.
Doesn't everybody?
Every Monday to Thursday, Jane and Fee keep the microphones on after their Times radio show.
I think if we were to do a Mr. and Mrs.
Oh, no.
How would that go in the booth?
Badly. It would go very badly.
Unencumbered and off air.
Two tiny women with gobs.
Off Air, the podcast. Now available on the Times radio app.
After a great start to the season, it's now 7 games without a win in the Premier League for Everton. They lost 1-0 at Brentford. It's left some fans with big question marks over Rafa Benitez, their manager. They were very unlucky, in my opinion, not to score at least once. Ivan Toney's penalty decided things. Benitez said, "It's a question of confidence, missing players. You could see what we're capable of doing at the beginning of the season. When we have everyone available, I'm confident we will do it again." But Alison, how worried should Benitez be?
He's quite a calm bloke, actually. So I don't think he'll be in panic mode. But he will know that their next game is against Liverpool. And if Liverpool do to a fragile Everton what they did to a fragile Man United, it will all blow up. You'd get away with a 0-0 because that's what Merseyside derby usually is, after all. And in fact, if it was 0-0 and two Everton players got sent off, I think most people would enjoy that and think, well, he doesn't mind giving his former club one, does he? But it does seem to be building to this slightly artificial crescendo of, oh, it's Liverpool next, and they're not showing. And when you compare what Liverpool are playing like at the moment and what Everton are playing like at the moment, it does feel like impending doom. So he will be worried. But I was looking at his demeanour on the touchline, and it is one of, he does look perplexed. He does look like someone who's worked hard on the training ground, told them what to do, and it's not quite coming off. Sometimes when you get injuries and key players missing, their bench was a non-entity, so that is an issue and probably has an impact on what he feels he can do and how the first team feel they're doing. It's Richarlison and Calvert-Lewin that are missing. I think a good team can absorb missing their top strikers, and they might not score the goals they deserve, but you can see the patterns of play and the toil and the work and everything, but it shouldn't permeate the whole team. And I think that's why he looked perplexed. It's like there's a slight acceptance there that they've been a bit unlucky with injuries and suspensions, and it's not gelling, and there's a palpable lack of confidence. I mean, that's probably more worrying than the fact that Richarlison's picking up too many yellow cards, for example, which I know Benitez went public on as being disappointed by. It's just this acceptance of your fate, and you sort of think, what is it about innate inability to rise above it? Because there's a big touch of the Tottenhams about Everton at the moment in terms of
Spursy.
A club that can't escape their history.
They're not Spursy because they haven't even got to the point of almost doing something, so I think that's not really defined in Spursy.
No, I mean more in terms of you become a caricature of yourself. And Everton are starting to be that.
Can I just first of all get confirmation from Alison? It is Rafa, isn't it? It's not Benitez. it's Rafa.
Rafa's Rafa, that's true.
Yeah, thank you. You see how Everton played at the beginning of the season and how good they were. And it all looked like a gamble that had paid off. And the problem is now they have had terrible injuries and to really key players. The biggest one, the most important one, is Dominic Calvert-Lewin. I mean, he is the central figure of that team. They went out and bought Damari Gray and Andros Townsend in the summer to complement him. That was the reason they were brought in. So to be without him has been massive, really significant. And we saw what they have been with him and what they are without him. And it's not just Everton. And I agree with Alison. I mean, you look at a team like Leeds United and they lose a player, and similar with Chelsea, they lose a player. You don't really see too much of a difference in how they operate. It's a system rather than individuals. But we saw it a little bit with Wolves last year with Raul Jimenez when he was out. It impacted them so much. The one thing, though, is that I find with Rafa Benitez is that he's promising at the moment, you know, you will see the real Everton when all these players are back. And it's a little bit, it's an excuse a little bit and an understandable one, a justified one. But the Newcastle period was, there were excuses at Newcastle a little bit with the lack of finances. And so it really, once he gets Calvert-Lewin back, once Doucouré is fit as well, that was his first game back, yeah, and he's a key player. Once he has all the players back, it has to work, because the Everton fans, or a section of the Everton fans, are so ready to turn on him.
Yeah.
And you can just picture Anfield on Wednesday, Goodison Park. Yeah. You can picture the away section of Liverpool fans chanting Benitez's name, just like teasing the Everton fans, and it will wind them up.
Yeah, Rafa's at the wheel might be getting some by Liverpool fans at Goodison Park. I think you're right, Alison, in talking about Tottenham Hotspur, that there probably should be a shift in expectation from the Everton fans. No one wants to do it at this stage of the season, but I think with the injuries and the lack of investment in the summer and the fact that there are going to be financial constraints at Everton, that Rafa Benitez may well end up being a bit of a steward for, you know, a custodian in terms of the squad fit for years to come? You know, get out the players that we can get out, try and be shrewd and get us through a period of what will be, I think, cost cutting, which isn't what you want, isn't what was promised by Farhad Moshiri, but it seemed to be the position that they're in now. And actually mid-table might be something that they might have to accept now for the next two or three seasons. Do you agree?
Oh, well, you put it like that, it seems entirely sensible, but I don't think there's a single Everton fan who would feel that way. Because they've had these spurts of glory. And like Tom said, there was one this season as well. But they've had them before where you think, oh, it's all coming right for Everton now. Yes, right. Yeah, one of the game's big teams. Yes, a club that deserves to be challenging for top four. And then it just sort of goes up with a little whimper. You're right. You should know who you are and what your plan is. But fans don't go along with that. They don't. They don't, as a fan, you can't accept that. And it's going to be harder for them to accept it with Rafa at the wheel, as you say. Because most of them didn't really want him.
Yeah, I think that's the tough thing. I think it is actually realising that you're not going to be as good as you were, and you've got a manager who used to be the Liverpool boss who you've got no connection with. Many of them didn't want in the first place. And you're sort of saying, what are we now? And you know, my message to the Everton fans would be patient. But then, who wants to wait, as you say, two, three seasons when you apparently had spent all this money? Well, you definitely did. But none of those signings have worked out, really. Just finally on it, Everton, I think they should have got a penalty in this game. Salomon Rondon. I mean, well, Pontus Janssen was basically trying to swap shirts with him early. And I was watching the highlights, actually, and I immediately saw it. You know, it does startle you when a player has got their entire, belly on show in the Premier League for no apparent reason. You know, he's not celebrating a goal, which is where I'd usually see a belly. And I'm just looking at it and I'm like, that's going to get looked at on VAR, surely. And I was actually watching the highlights expecting there to be a decision or a replay. And I was like, nothing happened there. And actually, I thought maybe it was just me until I was watching Match of the Day. Alan Shearer and Ian Wright both said that was a penalty. And I was like, yeah, it was. It looked like a stonewall penalty. Why don't you think it was checked or why don't you think it was given?
I don't know. I really don't know, because I agree. I thought it was a penalty. And it wasn't just, that kind of a pull down on a shirt you can get away with. But seeing a torso rather than a belly, Hugh.
Oh, I like Bellygate. It's better than torso.
On show. I don't know how it was missed with all the cameras, with the VAR in the ground. Yeah. Yeah, it was bizarre. Absolutely bizarre.
I think it was, if there's an explanation, it's that it was in the tempo of the game. The game was quite physical. And I just feel sometimes they want to start, as we know they do. They don't want VAR to start to alter the tempo.
If he goes ballistic and he starts waving his arms or rolling around or screaming at the ref, I think VAR has a look. I think there's a lot of players that know now, if they think something has happened, they have to do something. It's almost like you're alerting Stockley Park. You know, you're like, just stand there waving at the cameras, looking up at the spider cam, me there. I think that they almost have to milk it. And Rondon just sort of got on with the game. And I think that's the reason he never got a decision, actually.
But that was part of what happened with the Brentford penalty, wasn't it? It took quite a while to actually go back to it, to review it.
Yeah, that's true. So they should have done it for both of them. We want consistency, Stockley Park. I know you're listening. Let's move on. Talking about consistency, Brighton boss Graham Potter saying he disagrees completely with fans booing the side after a goalless draw with Leeds. They hit the woodwork, Brighton, three times in this game, but their winless run is now 9 games. They've never, ever finished in the top half of the top flight. They currently sit 8th in the Premier League. Potter said, maybe I need a history lesson on this football club, when he was asked about the booing. Alison, do the Brighton fans have a reason to boo? Because their record in the last 9, 7 draws, only 2 defeats.
Potter has gauged this one incorrectly. And he had a position. He had the chance to reframe what the booing meant, actually. He should have said, the game's about goals. We put in so much work. We're such a well-constructed team. He could have praised the way he'd set the team up. They're so hard to beat. And he, like any fan, would want that to produce a winning goal at the end. And so he completely understands that people turn up and pay their money because they want goal mouth action and everything's going well apart from that. But because he's got the basics right, because they are hard to beat, more goals will come. And he could have said, you know, explained a bit about Mopé's lack of confidence in recent weeks, but he's seen signs that he's back on track and so on. He could have completely reframed it and had everyone at Brighton thinking, oh, we're still so lucky to have Graham Potter. Instead, I think a little element of, I think he was just miffed because every time there's a managerial vacancy, Potter is linked to it. Up and coming, clever, young, relatively young English manager. Where will he go next? And he keeps talking about loyalty and how he loves the setup at Brighton and he wants to stay there. And he sort of feels, what? I've said all that. I've not gone anywhere. And now you're booing me. I'm not having it. I'm not having it. And look how much I've done for the club compared to everybody else. He's let that tiny sliver of ego come out, I think. Whereas, as I've said, I think he could have been cleverer with the booing and turned it into a positive and brought the fans back on side.
It's so funny because that the answer Alison suggested he should have said is just typical Graham Potter, the reasonable, you know, you're doing this job, you go into press conferences hoping that they're going to say something really interesting. And Graham Potter is a fascinating man to listen to, but press conference wise, it's all very sort of reasonable and low key a little bit. So I could not believe it when this happened and the irony in what he said. It wasn't straight. It was laced with such irony with the history lesson. But I think it was to do with the winless run. I think that is why they booed, and it was the frustration at not scoring goals, and it's quite understandable because they're the
it's not understandable.
No. It's understandable. Potter's reaction.
Oh, I see.
Yeah. Potter's reaction is understandable. Hugh just threw his arms out wide. Potter's reaction is understandable because that club, where they have come from. I mean, I think they've been in existence for 120 years, and 111 of them have been outside the top tier. I mean, this is not a historically big club. I mean, they're on the level of traditionally of what, like a Swansea City, clubs like that. And they're playing fabulous football. They lack quality in front of goal. And sadly, this kind of hangs on Neil Mopé's shoulders very heavily.
The only thing that I would say about that is I was amazed. I think we're all amazed that they didn't go and get a sort of proven goal scorer, is something that it would have been difficult for them to get. But you know, you see a Patson Daka, for example, going to Leicester City to almost be their second choice and play in the Europa League, and you sort of think he probably could have got, you know, someone who was scoring a goal a game in the Austrian Super League. You know, you probably could have brought that player into Brighton and put them up front and seen what they could have done. But the fact that they sort of stayed with the always injured, you know, Danny Welbeck, and the often not very lethal in front of goal Neil Mopé, I thought was very, very surprising.
They've also lost Glenn Murray, who I think he got 25 goals in their first 2 years in the Premier League. So he's left quite a big gap up front.
But again, Glenn Murray was, you know, we talk about Cristiano Ronaldo's age, you know, Glenn Murray was very much, you know, it's the end of his career. You have to plan for that, surely. You have to say, who are we going to replace him with? And it wasn't, you know, oh, Danny Welbeck's just been relegated, let's see if we can get him on. You know, it was very like, well, where's the planning for a striker here? You're in the Premier League. You do get a decent amount of money for staying up. You know, a striker is probably the area of the pitch that you always need to invest in if yours aren't going to score. So I found it very weird that sort of as a manager, as great as he is, Graham Potter, at the end of season meeting, surely the first thing that you said, what should we be doing this summer? It's like, we need to get a striker. We need a striker. But they didn't bring one in. So I find that to be very odd, at least one that I can't think of. So
do you now think all the Brighton fans are going to be going, oh, I'm so sorry I booed?
No.
Do you think this is going to help?
They're going to be slightly against Graham Potter, I think, because he went back at them. But I also think, you know, some of them should be like, well, he's got a point. You know, some of them are going to be rational thinkers. You're eighth in the Premier League, and the run is not, it's not a nine-game winless run with five defeats. You've lost two games in there. You've got seven draws, seven games where you weren't beaten. You're clearly an improving side. You're clearly better than you were last year. And you're eighth in the Premier League. I mean, there's nothing to boo. And it's a 0-0 draw. Right, it's against Leeds United, who are struggling. But we know they're not a bad side on their day, Leeds United. They hit the woodwork three times as well. Come on, would you have booed?
It's not, I wouldn't. I don't believe you should ever boo your own team. But Well, there's booing and
booing. But I wouldn't boo the people that do boo the team. Yeah.
No, there's booing and there's booing. As I say, he could have easily reframed that booing as frustration because we played so well, we deserve to be scoring more goals. As opposed to it being the normal boo, which means we don't like you anymore.
Let's talk about the manager in the other dugout very quickly. Marcelo Bielsa, he had a comment to make about the quality of the Premier League. He implied the schedule's overcharged. He said the trend was that every team was covering less distance this season. He added, commercialisation produces a product which is considerably worse. It gives me great sadness that football is deteriorating. Is it?
Well, his team are, so that's what he means, isn't it? I mean, he has been unable to keep them as fresh and intense and quite scary to play against as they were last season. There are elements where there are periods of games where they do look like they can't maintain it. We were all worried about burnout. We're always worried about burnout when there's a team coached by him. And so it's about how you plot that through. Jurgen Klopp learned the hard way. He saw his players get too tired towards the end of a campaign. So he said, right, we just ease up on the intensity. So I think Bielsa's coming through the prism of his own experience, which is that his way of playing football is just you can't relentlessly keep going. It's because there are lots of games and it is pressured and it will take its toll. I don't know why you'd blame market forces or capitalism for it.
Is the product considerably worse, though?
The product.
Do you feel the product of football? The
Leeds.
Amount?
Leeds are considerably worse. They're less entertaining to watch. Yes, but I don't think. If you substitute the word football for Leeds, yes, he's spot on. But if otherwise, no, I don't think so.
No, I agree. Watching the Premier League, I haven't been disappointed. I mean, we can talk about a close title race. It's exciting. That doesn't mean the quality of the football is good, but it is, you know. At the same time, a lot of the top teams have such huge squads now where they just move players in and out with such ease. You know, the injuries they suffer, it's easy to deal with. And those with less finances are struggling.
Okay, I mean, I don't necessarily disagree with him. I'm sort of coming round the older I get to the idea of 18 teams in the Premier League. We could talk about this at length on another day. We'll talk about an independent regulator later. Maybe it will come up. This is probably a side note from what Marcelo Bielsa had to say. I still feel like there is a lot of football. And if we're going to keep Premier League teams in the EFL Cup, I sort of think that maybe, you know, if there's going to be three competitions, we don't need as many league games. I'm going to run for the hills now. But you guys can let me know on social media what you think about that. We're going to be talking about Richard...
Super League.
Yeah,
Super League.
Exactly. We're going to talk about Richard Masters, the Premier League chief executive next, who has finally had something to say about Newcastle United. The Premier League chief executive, Richard Masters, has finally broken his silence about Newcastle United. He's given an interview to the BBC. He was asked about making a distinction between the Saudi state and the 80% owners of Newcastle United, the PIF, Public Investment Fund of Saudi Arabia. Masters said, there is a corporate difference between the two. There is. That is what we're investigating, whether the Saudi state could control the club through the investment fund. We have received assurances, though, that that is not the case. Human rights groups have said the deal is an attempt to improve the country's image by sports washing its record on human rights abuses. Masters went on to say, you can't have one rule for one and one for another, and so Newcastle will be run on the right basis. PIF are an investor in many other companies in this country, and maybe football is being targeted and talked about in a different way. I can't choose who is chairing a football club. The owner's test doesn't let us take a view on that. Which seems to me like another person pretending sports washing doesn't exist because they're pointing the finger at other sectors and not understanding that their sector is slightly different.
Yes, if I own a telecoms company, no one's going to accuse me of sports washing it, are they? Because
exactly.
It's not a sport.
Exactly.
Ridiculous.
Exactly. So I find that to be slightly odd, but I also don't think there's a standout company that the PIF is using to change the image of their nation, unless I can, you know, I don't associate Uber or McDonald's with the Saudi Arabian state, but you may well soon, by some changes that I imagine will be made over the coming years, associate Newcastle United very strongly with the Saudi state. So that is
what is so disappointing about what you just read out, Hugh. Clearly, it's possible to say all that he said. It's ignoring the elephant in the room. It's just appallingly bland and lacking in insight. And fearful. He does not address what the role of the Premier League's image is in the world and how it could be hijacked by anybody with enough money. As you say, he doesn't even mention the term sports washing. So if he really wanted to make an argument, what he should have done was to have said, I believe sports washing to be this. I don't believe in this instance that this is possible, and explain why. And he couldn't, so he didn't.
Yeah. Very disappointing, Tom.
I thought it was really interesting. I think it's at the end of the interview where it's put to him about the independent regulator and the government-backed independent regulator, and his suggestion was it would make no difference, which, you know, we'd expect him to say, but I felt like a lot of what he was saying suggested he didn't have a huge say in this. And of course he does, but it felt like there were influences from elsewhere that he wanted to speak about and couldn't. The worst part for me, I mean, this all looks really bad in print, but it seemed foolish to do it as a broadcast interview because it comes across so poorly on camera, especially probably most of all when he's asked about the conflict that it shows with the Rainbow Laces campaign, because he responds by saying, of course, I see it, and basically says, my concern is this. This is what I've got to deal with, and that's the directors and owners test, which says to me it's, you know, a box that can be ticked. They're two separate entities. There's a difference. Okay, go through.
I mean, there was also something ridiculous that Richard Masters said, which was essentially that we could, if we see that Mohammed bin Salman, who of course stands accused by many of the intelligence agencies of ordering the murder of the journalist Jamal Khashoggi, you know, if we see that he's involved directly with giving orders to the PIF about how Newcastle United should be run, that we can remove their ownership. I mean, do you really think that Richard Masters is ever going to press the red button on Mohammed bin Salman and his ownership of Newcastle United? That will never, ever, ever happen. There won't be any circumstance under which Newcastle United... they've done it in American sport. They have very different rules in terms of ownership. They did manage to get the owner of the LA Clippers to sell his club after he was caught making, you know, overtly racist comments. You know, within the space of 2 weeks, it was... basically, this is the price you've got to sell, and someone bought it. You know, and teams of that ilk do not become available very often because of the fact that it's a franchise model, and even if your team is horrendously bad, you will always, always make a huge amount of money in American sports. So, you know, it's a big decision to force an owner to sell. You could never do that in football. You know, firstly, they'll buy another club, but in reality, what, you're just going to name a price then? Are you going to buy it back yourself? I mean, are the Premier League going to take ownership and say, like, well, you know, you've defaulted, so here you go, here's your 1.5 billion, and we'll do whatever it might be at the time, and we'll take the club from you and what, run it ourselves? It's just not going to happen. So I found that to be very, very odd. Aside from all the moral stuff that he mentioned, or rather didn't mention, again, I felt like, you know, I was disappointed in what Eddie Howe had to say, in that he sort of didn't even acknowledge the issues. Richard Masters then did acknowledge the issues, and yes, I can see the conflict like you mentioned, Tom, but that is sort of not my thing, and it almost undermines everything that football is trying to do in a positive sense in so many different areas, that, you know, well, we didn't have a rule for morals, so we couldn't do anything about it.
Once you have some degree of power and you refuse to acknowledge what sports washing is and you allow the takeover to happen, you have bolted the door completely and there is no turning back at all. I'm struggling to see what could possibly now happen for the Premier League to act decisively. And I don't even know if there's any mechanism in place for them to do so anyway.
What I found strange was the line as well, that we can't have one rule for one and one for another, which almost seemed like a massive admission, you know, basically saying we've got other sports washing teams in the Premier League, so I can't stop another one. which I also found to be very, very strange.
A very odd sentence, actually, wasn't it?
Yeah, well, it was just sort of like, you know, well...
It was vague and perturbing.
We've allowed it before, so we've got to allow it again, it was what I took from it. And I just thought, where's the line? Will there ever be a line?
Yeah, I agree with you that was what he was, part of what he was saying, but also... To suggest this one was similar to anything else is extraordinary. The situation with PIF or the Saudi state, its involvement in general, it's remarkable for him to say. I mean, it was clearly an interview he did not want to do and was pushed into. I don't know how many weeks on we are now, but we've sat on this podcast saying the silence is
honestly
definite.
I think he's doing this interview because of the independent regulator story. But he did answer questions on Newcastle. You almost want to give him credit for that, but he should have come out weeks and weeks ago and spoken about it. But actually, I think that, you know, there are many people associated with the Premier League who have been coming out to sort of almost respond to all of the stuff in the media that the government has been putting forth about why football does need a regulator. You almost felt they'd all come out and said, like, we're going to start doing some media here to get our points across about why it would be bad. And inevitably, he had to then answer questions on Newcastle.
It shows how defensive they are about this independent regulator that he knew he would be quizzed on the Saudi state and Newcastle and the takeover to actually go up for this.
I just find the fact that there might be assurances to be really nonsensical, but there is a point raised by Newcastle fans that it's just like, well, why can't our owners come into the league? You know, there are other clubs who have, you know, certainly moral issues hanging over them. You know, some of them have been, you know, criminal allegations, etc., elsewhere in the world, all allegations. But so far, I don't think we've had a real episode in the Premier League that we would all stand up and say they need to be out. But maybe Newcastle's the first. But it almost, for me, was like, we need an independent regulator, clearly, then. Richard Masters is saying, because I have no control, I couldn't have stopped this. It's almost like saying to football, we do need an independent regulator, whilst at the same time saying it would be a terrible idea, we don't need an independent regulator. Because I think if there was an independent regulator, maybe PIF wouldn't have been able to buy Newcastle.
But his suggestion was that even if the government was involved, it still would have gone through.
Yeah, but I hate that rhetoric of football's being targeted.
Oh,
because,
I agree.
Because again, the sports, like I say, then it's everyone pretending that sports washing isn't a thing. There aren't organisations being used for the explicit use of basically propaganda. There are very few that I can think of on the top of my head organisations that have been invested in for reasons other than money. Yeah. The other investments that they have are about making money. There is no investment here about making money. They're going to lose billions of pounds on Newcastle, but they believe it's worth it because there is a greater goal. And that's what I mean. I don't understand it. It's not even disappointing to me. I just don't understand why people are acting like they don't understand what's happening here. By people, I mean people like Richard Masters, who were very much in the middle of it. He knows exactly what it is. So, you know.
Is there a degree of, I don't know, fear that if you were to be proactive about sports washing, you might be worried that where does it end? Because the vast majority of owners of football clubs have a motivation that isn't
they're worried.
This is a great business deal and I want to give lots of jobs to people. There's a narrative behind every reason for owning something.
The overarching worry for the Premier League is the billionaires will take their money to another league and Serie A will be the league that has all the stars in and the teams that are getting to the quarterfinals of the Champions League and having these great nights. They truly believe that they'll stop buying our clubs. The money will go elsewhere. And obviously they're an organisation that is there to make money for the clubs and they don't want the money elsewhere. They don't want the broadcasting deals elsewhere. So it's just about protecting themselves. And I think that's the biggest fear. You see Christian Perslow and Steve Parrish coming out in the last week as well, you know, just talking about how ridiculous it would be to have an independent regulator. But the independent regulator would surely speak to people like them in football to come to a consensus over what the best thing for football would be. No one is implying, as far as I can see, that the independent regulator is a separate body to people in football, you know, has no people involved in football. It's just politicians saying, no, that, nah, don't fancy them being, you know, making up rules as they wish. Surely people in football will be part of the independent regulator. And really, the rules that the independent regulator is looking to bring in, you know, they're talking about teams like Bury and Macclesfield. You know, they're talking about the rules being there to not lead to the destruction of football clubs. I don't think there's going to be many rules there. Maybe Richard Marsh is right. They're not going to stop people buying football clubs that have more money than anyone else in the world. I don't think that's why we need an independent regulator. I just feel like it's not strange. That's the wrong word. It's entirely predictable why people involved with the Premier League would come out against it. But the argument is strange. It doesn't really make sense because it's almost like they're arguing for a complete worst case scenario instead of what is really what would be most reasonable and logical. And maybe I'm naive about what the independent regulator would be. You know?
Well, it's fear of the unknown, isn't it? Mm. I mean, people become very chippy straight away when there's a fear that it might curb their ability to spend or how they operate their bottom line and all that. I mean, it's more fear of the unknown. And whereas you're quite right, the more reasonable approach would be to say, we can work with a regulator. They'll be, as you said, they'll be football people. We've seen how important the fans are to the game. Mm. We want them represented better. We want to make sure we're an actual family rather than just storming ahead without thinking holistically. You can frame it better than saying, oh, no, it won't work. It could kill us. That's fear speaking as opposed to rationally plotting, yeah, we could work together. This is fine.
Yeah. Look, I find it to be very strange just to simply to come out with the takeover, to say it's been confirmed, to say we've got assurances that the Saudi state won't have any control in leading this, despite the fact that Mohammed bin Salman is the chairman of the PIF. And then to come out in the interview and say that basically we need to make sure that doesn't happen. It's like, well, he's like, we've got legal assurances. Kept saying that. We've got legal assurances. And it's like, right, okay. But is there any way of you making sure it doesn't happen? And that's the bit where he didn't seem
to. Well, the word assurances isn't legal anyway. That's an illogical phrase, legal assurances. It's insurance. It's a fact.
Yeah.
It's law. It's legally binding. An assurance sounds like people have been out for candlelit suppers and had a lot of caviar somewhere, doesn't it?
Sounds like a promise. We've come to the end of this week's episode of the Game Podcast. I say this week's. We'll be back on Thursday reacting to all the Premier League because we've got live football coming up tomorrow, Wednesday night. We've got one game on Thursday night, the small matter of Manchester United against Arsenal. But we will be back with you on Thursday morning looking back at all of that. Remember, if you enjoy the podcast, rate us, leave us a review. Make sure you're subscribed as well to The Times and The Sunday Times. If you sign up today, you will get yourself 1 month free. Just go online, check it out. It's thetimes.co.uk/thegame. We'll see you very soon. Take care.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Late bloomers tend to have more curiosity. They tend to have more resilience.
There are stories and mythology that this country has woven around Black men.
This is the cavalry, right? These are the leaders, the hometown heroes and local leaders. And we are.
It's a survival mechanism to just be like wary of the police.
What if everything we've been taught is just all wrong?
What's worth more than this fear right now?
And that rising after failure is part of the glory of being a human being.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.